Hello to anyone listening. There is a trigger warning for this episode as it discusses Lauren's experiences as an incest victim survivor. Lauren would also like for you to know that she's safe and supported. For anyone listening, if you need support or advice, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14.
Welcome to The Personhood. It's Nat Siargan here, your person, digital mentor, and strategist for the day. Our Passion to Paycheck Creators series explores in-depth conversations with professional creators across the world from different industries and areas of expertise who will share how they were able to turn their passion and projects into a profession and series of paychecks. Are you ready to grow together? Let's go.
In today's chat, we're learning from creator and artist Lauren Matthews, a multidisciplinary artist living on Wadawurrung land in regional Victoria, Australia. She's an emerging artist, researcher, feminist, activist, and survivor. Lauren came to art later in life and works on projects using the tradition of craft practice to generate social change through the tenacity of materials. She explores domestic dichotomies and social issues from the intensity of trauma to creating works that challenge patriarchal assumptions and the culture of owning and collecting objects. Her practice is very personal and explores her childhood experiences. With limited recollection of being a child because of the incest and childhood sexual abuse inflicted from an early age, as a result of this trauma, she's experienced dissociative amnesia as a way of helping her feel safe. However, she is a survivor and fights for social change. She's gone on to become a PhD candidate at Federation University, exploring the topic survival memories, how representing and naming incest survival could challenge taboos, influence public discourse, ideologies, and contribute to social change through the history and tenacity of materials. Not only does her background provide her with a very unique voice, the materials and methods she uses, embroidering and hand quilting, are predominantly viewed as craft-based, allows Lauren to provide a public demonstration of what is often a private domestic art form. Her practice builds on the rich tradition of feminist artists who articulate their trauma through text, textiles, and DIY principles. In this episode, Lauren will share her personal journey and what she's learned along the way on the power of risk-taking, change-making, and sitting with discomfort. Let's crack on. This is Lauren Matthews for The Personhood. Can you hit the rewind button and take it all the way back to the beginning? What was your upbringing like and how has this influenced you as a person, creator and artist today?
Yeah, thank you for that really lovely intro as well, Nat. It's so exciting to be here on The Personhood and talking about kind of my passion to paycheck journey. And I kind of started life in at the time what I thought was a really boring suburban jungle in Melbourne, born in the early 1980s. And I thought my childhood was incredibly normal. I just thought, you know, mum, dad, white picket fence, that was my life, went to school. And then it wasn't until later on in life that I realised that actually my childhood was pretty terrible. I had developed at the age of 2 dissociative amnesia, which is where you completely disassociate from stressful situations. So my father was a perpetrator of incest and that abuse continued from the ages of 2 till 14 years old. And my tiny 2-year-old brain was incredible and completely disassociated. So I actually have no memories of anything that happened where my father was present. So whether that be a holiday, whether that be in our house, whether that be in a public setting, I have no memories of when he is around. And so I just assumed that that's what everyone's memories were like, that they didn't really remember bits and pieces. So if someone asked me, for example, oh, what was your 5th birthday party like? Or what was your favorite Christmas? I would kind of recite a photograph. So I remember seeing pictures in albums, and then I would tell people the memory based on what I remembered from the photo album. And later on, when I went through kind of a procedure of a mental health diagnosis and had a nervous breakdown and ended up in a psychiatric facility, I started using this technique called EMDR, which is eye movement desensitization and reprocessing. And through that, I was able to tap into those memories and actually find out that my childhood was really horrific. So it's a bit of a, like, kind of a gut punch, you know, to think that you've built up this picture based on happy photographs, because everyone's childhood photo album is full of smiling, happy faces. There's no, like, dad pictures in it. And so I built up this whole memory bank of images based on photographs, when really I actually had no idea what my life looked like whatsoever. So it's kind of wild. From the outside, it looks like a really, you know, suburban upbringing, went to a good school, got good grades, you know, my father died when I was a teenager. So, you know, a bit of a sad story there. And then it actually ended up finding it was a pretty wild ride and pretty traumatic. So that's where I came from. Place of intensity.
No, totally. And, like, thank you so much for sharing that with me. I know that, you know, it particularly for someone like yourself to go through something like that and be sitting here as a successful artist, like, that's really powerful. And I'm so sorry that you had to go through something like that. But it also sounds like, you know, you had to, I can't even imagine what it was like to go through something like that. And I'm not going to say that I know what that would feel like, but what kind of person did you need to become to kind of, you know, identify this trauma and go through this healing process, as you kind of mentioned, going into psychiatric, getting EMDR, getting, you know, the support and the help that you needed and wanted? What was that journey like?
It's been a wild ride. First off, I think it's really brave of you to want to have me on the podcast to talk about my experience as an incest victim survivor, because incest really is the last taboo in society. Whenever it's mentioned, it's mentioned in kind of this rhetoric of like the Game of Thrones, or it's, you know, people from the American South, you know, that kind of kissing cousins narrative. It's sort of seen as a bit salacious or a bit of a joke. And you kind of notice, once you're aware of it, you notice it a lot. And, you know, people are like, oh, did you watch Game of Thrones? It's this, that, and the other. And it's like, actually, that's like a lot of people's reality. And so it's really gutsy of you to have me on to talk about it, because I find, particularly through my research, that not many people want to speak about it. There's really limited research. And I think with the advent of the internet, it's really limited research, because people, you know, when you type it into a search engine, you kind of get flagged as if you're looking for child pornography. So it's like our stories as victim survivors are seen as too terrifying, and they're blocked, or seen as kind of pornographic, and they're hidden, when really it's such a traumatic, horrible thing to experience, that kind of violation of young children. And I think that we can't, and certainly before I knew I was a victim survivor, you can't believe that incest is real, because the moment that you do, it means that every home where families live could potentially be unsafe. And you just can't believe that where you live is unsafe. You can't believe that the person that you married or a family member is unsafe. You have to believe that where children are is the safest possible place they could be. And I'm really about getting people to think twice about that and be aware, you know. So that's kind of a little bit about sort of where I come from in terms of framing. And honestly, to get to this point, I'm just really lucky that I'm alive. I've met a lot of people on this journey who have undergone similar treatment to me, who are not here, who took their own lives, or who have experienced a life of drugs and alcohol. I think what has saved me from that is my tiny brain as a kid was really clever and disassociated. So I was never really present for the abuse. I was just, you know, who knows where I was, but that I'm grateful to that little girl every day. When I see a picture of her, I know that it's me because people have told me it's me, but I don't necessarily feel that connection to my younger self, where there's kind of that disconnect, but I'm so grateful for her. So I was really lucky. I think, though, growing up, when you come from a household like that, if it had happened to me today, I think people would have figured it out, because there's so much more training. But all of these really predominant trauma indicators as a child, perfectionism, having unrelenting standards, so you're always having
you always kind of have to be the best person in the room, because if you're the smartest person in the room, people are only going to notice that you're smart or that you're funny. They're not going to notice what's hiding behind that. So you use that as kind of a coping mechanism, and I threw myself into schoolwork and achieving and ultimately building a career, because I only found out that this was my experience in 2018. That's when we started doing the memory, the EMDR and memory retrieval work. So I'd always had flashbacks, and I have had phantom pain for a very long time. They equate it to if someone has lost a limb and you still feel pain from that limb, even if you don't have it. So I have chronic pain in my shoulder and hip, and that's linked to core memories that I didn't even know existed. I was kind of really fortunate that I had a massive nervous breakdown, which sounds really weird. So I had a pretty successful career in the not-for-profit sector as an advocate and as a CEO. And one day something sort of snapped inside me. It was a pretty intense and stressful job. And I don't remember driving home that day. And I got home and I said to my husband, something's just not quite right. I'd already been on sort of psych medication, you know, a small dose of antidepressants and anti-anxiety because I'd been having panic attacks. I just assumed it was all a chemical imbalance in my brain and, you know, stress management and things like that, like most people think. And I ended up in a psychiatric ward a couple of days later after I finished that job. And I was there for 2 weeks. And one day I was standing in the corridor, and you kind of, there's a program while you're in a psych hospital, particularly a private psych hospital. And you can go to a group, or you can go listen to talks, or, you know, things like that. And I decided one day to step into the art room. And so I went into the art room and I just did some drawing, and I did some embroidery actually, because I remembered that my grandma had taught me embroidery. So I just sort of did that and drew on that kind of skill that I had in my memory bank. Because I remember everything that happened outside of where my dad was. So I have beautiful memories of so many moments. But I started sewing in that room. And then after I was discharged, I did weekly art therapy. And over time, like, we moved to the country, my partner and I, and my art therapist said, Lauren, I think you've got a folio of work here. Maybe you might want to apply to art school. Mm. And at this point, I hadn't returned to employment. I was on income protection. So I was very fortunate. I suppose that's one thing to really acknowledge, is the privilege that I came from, in that I was able to afford private health insurance, which meant that I could access psychiatric services. And I had a tiny bit of money in my super. I think I got $800 a month that gave me a payment because I wasn't able to work. So that is my one bit of advice to creators, because creators are really terrible at paying themselves superannuation. On your superannuation, always tick the box and pay a little bit extra to get the income protection component, because that meant that we at least had something to fall back on. If I had have paid a little bit more, I would have had my equivalent wage. I was on six figures before. And so, yeah, just a tip for creators, pay for that income protection component in your superannuation.
That is a really good tip around the super. I did not know that existed. I also want to go back to the fact that you have been able to transform. You said that you felt a lot of, obviously, physical pain alongside the actual pain of experiencing this trauma. But the ability for you to transform this pain into your power almost, and the fact that it also led you to this of, you know, finding your art and the sewing and the embroidery and art therapy. But did it, because I'm looking at your very incredible CV in front of me right now, and your education, the fact that you started with social work and your PhD, has education played a big role in your journey as well?
Oh, education is what helped me survive. I love learning. And for me, because I don't have those memories of childhood, my greatest memories are of school. I'm just so passionate about education. I was actually on the board of my old school for a decade as well after I finished, because I was just so grateful for the opportunities that I got there. And I just love learning. You know, I'm on, I think, degree number 5 right now. I love the structure of it.
Yeah. It's...
I love, you know, there's deadlines. It's interesting. You're taken to different places when you're, whatever you're studying, whether it's accounting, whether it's visual arts, whether it's social work, whatever it might be, you're taken somewhere else to learn something new. And your brain, my tiny brain as a kid saved me. And then my brain has always saved me because learning has always been there. And so it was a giant hex debt. But that is what is really exciting, is that's what kept me safe, is learning. I was lucky. I chose education. Some people choose drugs. Some people choose alcohol. Some people choose gambling. Some people choose ending their own lives. I chose learning because that's the thing. It's where I felt safe. And it's where I feel the safest. It's where I feel the most confident, because you know what you know. And that's a really wonderful thing, and it's a really solid foundation for me, because everything was so unknown. Through education, I was able to build up this knowing. I know what I know, and I've been a subject matter expert on things, and that's nice to have that foundation of knowledge and be able to trust what I know, because everything else has been so uncertain and transient.
Yeah, and like, I totally relate. I feel, you know, education and knowledge is our greatest power. And particularly in Australia, we've got a really good system, in the sense of, you know, there's the fact that we have this access to a really good schooling system, universities, like the fact that we can put it in HEX. Yes, it's a debt, which sucks, but so much freedom in Australia, speaking from personal experience. But I can relate to you in the sense we migrated from Indonesia after the 1998 civil war crisis, and education has been so paramount in actually helping build a career and being able to take these opportunities. Like you said, it's the greatest privilege to kind of have these opportunities.
And it builds communities of trust and safety and connection. And I think for survivors of trauma, whether that be a fleeing war, whether that be people like myself who are victim survivors, I was a victim survivor of long-term incest, but there's people who may have experienced single instance sexual abuse or trauma, you know, people with accidents, people with disabilities, newly arrived communities. Education is so important, yet it is often only the privileged that get to access it. I was, you know, I'm lucky in many ways in that I grew up as a white Anglo person in suburban Melbourne on a scholarship with access to a private school and a good public school in primary school. Whereas I think in so many communities, people who have experienced trauma are often also living in the most disadvantaged communities where the education isn't as great as it potentially could be. So I think we still have a long way to go in terms of our advocacy to make sure that everyone can access the same opportunities and high quality education, because we are so lucky here in Australia. But if I was living in a remote Indigenous community, potentially my access to opportunities is not going to be as great. So it's how we think about our advocacy, and as people who have benefited from strong systems and supports, how do we then contribute back out there into the world? And it's not through this kind of savior complex and performative action. It's about how is that embedded in our lives in terms of how we contribute back to make sure that everyone can access those opportunities. Because I say to my psychiatrist all the time, I'm so lucky. I'm so lucky that I was born where I was born, and my family weren't wealthy but had a significant income. My grandparents were a great support. I had good schooling. And she's like, Lauren, what happened to you is the horror of horrors. It's everyone's worst nightmare, you know, to be abused kind of every day of your life is pretty horrific. And I still frame that in that I was so lucky that I was able to have the resources to get out. But I also have to remember that with my privilege, I also have experienced such trauma, and one doesn't necessarily negate the other. And childhood trauma doesn't discriminate. It's happening in low-income communities, and it's happening in the houses of billionaires. You know, that's the thing. And that's why we need to break those taboos and have these hard conversations and public conversations, so that people are always thinking and questioning. And that's what's so important. Always be inquiring.
I totally agree. And I feel that from your presence. I know I've only known you for less than a week, but you have such a presence and you have such a powerful voice. And alongside that, though, you are also this incredible incredible artist. You're a community art facilitator, a researcher, an activist, a conversation starter. I want to dive a little bit more about the work that you're doing and the community that you're embedded into. Tell me more about that.
So I live in a small country town called Balan, which is on Wadawurrung country in central Victoria. And what is incredible about where I live is it's also the birthplace of Bunjil the Eagle. So Bunjil the Eagle is kind of the creator spirit for many Indigenous people. So it's kind of like I live in the equivalent of Bethlehem, I suppose, Australian Bethlehem. And you know, it's such a privilege to be able to live and create on that land and be part of a really incredible creative community. So I kind of tap into creativity in so many different ways where I live and with what I do. So I am a member of my local art collective and we might put on different art shows and things like that. I participate a lot. Ballarat's kind of the biggest town near where I live. And so I've been really lucky to be supported a lot by the city of Ballarat. So I have a solo show coming up in February, which is really exciting. And that's funded by them. I've accessed a lot of grants and wonderful opportunities through that. I also have been just dipping my toe in the water of doing some community art facilitation, because having that background in social work and public policy, I have that skill set around community development and I didn't want to lose that. And so I went a couple of months ago, sort of middle of last year, posted an embroidery that I did around reproductive rights, particularly with all of the abortion reform that was happening in the US. And I was really distressed by that, because I was thinking, what about kids like me? What about someone who is 11 years old and is pregnant to their father and the government's going to make you have your father's baby? That just blew my mind that that would happen. And that is going to happen in many, many states. So I created this embroidery work because sometimes you just need to stab something thousands of times to feel a little bit better. And so I created this embroidery of a reproductive system. And I posted it on my Instagram, and someone that I knew in my community who happened to work for the local council contacted me and said, "Hey, Lauren, let's catch up for a coffee. I'm really interested in your work." I was like, "Yeah, sure." You know, I'm always like yes to opportunities, even though they terrify the shit out of me. I'm like, yes, I will go to this meeting. I'll have this conversation. I'll see where this goes. And I never used to be like that. I used to be very risk averse. And now I'm like, yes, and I'll go. Mm. And went along. And Beck and I were chatting and she's like, "Oh, have you heard of the United Nations 16 days of activism against gender-based violence?" And I had from the past, and she said, "It'd be really great if you would facilitate a community arts project as part of the council's response to that 16 days of activism." And I thought, oh, yes, I put together a proposal. And in the beginning, it kind of started out as I thought I'd run a beginner's quilting workshop or sewing workshop and people could learn a skill, a couple of people, and we'd hang them on the wall and that'd be that. And then I thought, oh, and I went back to my kind of, I'm all about bringing people together and thinking, how can everyone benefit from each other? So got this group of people together from local agencies and organisations, invited women and non-binary people to come along to this forum. And so I had different speakers and we spoke about kind of the state of play of gender-based violence where we live, because a lot of people think, oh, that happens somewhere else. You know, women are hurt and non-binary people are hurt in other places. Children aren't abused here, when really it's happening next door and you just choose not to see it or you can't see it. So we had this conversation, and during that, these incredible kind of networks started to be forming. And, you know, the Lions Club of Quilters, for example, connected in with the local police about donating food vouchers so police could hand them out when they go on domestic violence calls. The CWA were like, "We've got this money, we don't know what to do." And then a local organisation that supports women and families fleeing family violence, they're like, "Oh, we could use some funds to do this part of the project." And it was like, oh, cool, these are things happening. And I asked everyone, I said, "Is a beginner's sewing workshop actually what you want to do?" And they're like, "No, we actually want to come together and just sit as women and non-binary people and sew. And if you could teach us and we could come together." And I sort of thought, oh, this is, maybe we could make a community quilt. I ran sessions and it was about reclaiming spaces as well. So we had sessions in a pub, and often pubs are the source of gender-based violence because, you know, they're kind of linked to that very sort of hyper-masculine environment, but also the impact of alcohol and particularly women's safety. But I thought, no, you know, this, we have a lovely pub. and let's reclaim this space for women. They were really supportive of us, of them being part of the project and us sewing.
Oh, I love that.
So it's a reclaiming that space. We had a lot of workshops in our arts collective shed, which is located next door to the mechanics in the town I live in. It's a converted shed and it's really great. And I did some in the library, that's sort of cool. Like public performance in a sense, where I just sat there sewing and people, little kids and mums and grandparents, you know, would come up to me. Some people chose to draw with fabric markers. Some people sewed. Some people quilted. People did all these different things. And I had a street stall as well at our – we had this autumn festival in spring because we kind of had to acquit the grant before the end of the year. It's a very country town thing, you know. You get this funding and then we couldn't do it. And so there's like, quick, we're going to have spring into autumn so we can use the funds before the end of the year. So we had this autumn festival in spring, which is very funny. And I had a street stall there and I asked people to write down on these squares of fabric what respect meant to them. And that was women, children, men, people of all ages, you know. We're quite an agricultural town, so there was farming people, there was tourists, there was local residents, people who commute to Melbourne every day to work, people that work sort of remotely. And so everyone was kind of thinking about what respect looked like and different people wrote different things. Men contributed. It was really interesting to hear what people thought respect was. And in the end, all of this stuff came together in our library because libraries are such an important place of safety in community. You know, you can always go to the library and someone's always going to be there to help you. And it's often the first port of call. It's non-judgmental. These quilts now hang in the library that I made with the community. And I kind of sewed them together and did the quilting part of it. And it's really amazing to see this quilt hanging there talking about what respect is. And it's so random because, you know, Summer's like, respect is making sure that women are safe and things like that. And another one is a picture of a kid with goldfish because this little girl, Phoebe, respect was making sure the fish get fed every day on time and that you respect all of their different colours because all of their colours are beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
It was really special and I really loved doing that project. So I'm excited at the prospect of maybe doing more community art facilitation as the time goes because I think skill sharing is also where it's at. If you know how to do something, it's like what you do now. You know how to do things. Well, let's share it. Don't just keep it to yourself. Show people how to do it as well. And I think that's what I love what you do with the personhood in terms of that skill sharing. And I try to do the same thing, you know, teaching people how to sew. And I'm shocked that people don't know how to sew.
Guilty.
Yeah, but it's people of all ages. Like I was surprised when like a 60-year-old woman asked me to teach her how to sew. I kind of had this really gendered assumption that women of that age would know how to sew. So that was more shame on me rather than shame on them. But yeah, I do.
But it's also like, you know, things. Yes, you do. But incredible things. But also, you know what I find interesting as well, just hearing how this has kind of led to this, is the fact that as an artist, and I get this a lot from different creators as well, but there's an element of fear in posting on social. And I thought it was really interesting that the domino effect has kind of come from this place where you posted your work on social and it took one person to notice it who was linked to the United Nations project, and this domino effect just started to happen. Yeah.
And that's the thing. I was always scared to post. Like, I'm not scared to post because my Instagram is, it's very me. It's just a bit of everything.
Mm.
It's not curated in any way. It's just me, genuine. That's who I am. I share my story. I'm very political. But I also share what a delicious dinner was or a picture of the dog, you know, a fun outfit. And to have someone see my work that way and want to engage me in this project was really cool, but equal part terrifying because it was kind of stepping back into my old life in a sense, but I'm a new person.
Right.
And so that first forum, when I went there, I was so anxious and I was so scared because I thought the last time I did this, it all like ended up in flames and I was in a psychiatric hospital by the end.
Right.
So it was about making sure that I was taking the right risks and being held in a safe place, but also holding people in a safe way too when they're in a space that I'm in. I think that's really important, is to hold the space for others too. Hold it for yourself and hold it for other people, and let other people hold you as well. So that's kind of...
Yeah, no, I agree.
And so many opportunities have come to me through social media. I did an incredible week with Flax Design Studio in Melbourne with 10 people, and they had this mentoring program, which was in honour of David, who's the founder of Flax, co-founder with his now departed partner, Mark, who we will always love and remember. And they wanted to give the opportunity to 10 people who wouldn't normally get their foot in the door in creative industries, in visual arts, in design. And I'm one of those people that probably wouldn't get a foot in the door. I'm kind of a little bit older, but also, you know, my story is pretty full on. My practice is craft-based, which is often disregarded by the kind of capital A art community. You know, having mental health issues, so having a disability, you know, you're often not given opportunities. And so there was this group of 10 of us, all from different backgrounds, all different experiences. And we got to experience the most incredible opportunity. We met world-famous artists, were introduced to galleries, got to spend, you know, hours of time. People gave up their time to spend with us, like sharing their experiences, you know, Andy Lee, Kylie Kwong, you know, like getting to spend time with them and have them share their experiences made me feel like, oh, well, everyone's got a story. My story, it might be a bit harder to swallow, but it's just my story as well. And so I'm always about sharing my story too, because it just means that the person sitting next to you might feel a bit more confident to then try something themselves too. And since doing that, and, you know, I found out about Jungle Club, which is where I am now doing this creative residency. I found out about that online. You know, taking those opportunities and running with them is really exciting. And especially when you live in a regional area, you need to look for other avenues to find opportunities for success and connection. Mm.
You're so right, because historically, the journey of the personhood, you know, one of the big problems that we're tackling is figuring out how to democratize opportunities for creators, because it's not an equal level playing field. And particularly for marginalized communities, there's a lot of communities that are underrepresented, undervalued, and marginalized. And for Flax Studios to create a space like a mentorship program and really create with impact is really, you know, I would love to see more organizations and businesses and brands doing that, because this is the only way that we can really tackle this democratization from an opportunities and financial perspective. Hey peeps, if you're still here, we bloody appreciate you. Did you know we offer one-on-one creator mentorship, fun brand clarity social media and content workshops, career coaching, and digital products, including some freebies? Head over to www.thepersonhood.com to learn more, and don't forget to check out all the links and resource in the show notes.
You know, like, access is so hard. I was really lucky. I went to a private school, and in Melbourne it's very much focused on what school you went to, and you know, people get to sit in rooms not because of what they've learned or their journey. They get to sit in a room because they had the money to access opportunities that many people didn't. And I think that's what I loved about the Flack opportunity, was that not only were they recognizing their experience of they came from nothing and they didn't come from families that had access, you know, they'd experienced homelessness and different challenges, and then to be able to build up a business and then use the money from their business to then reinvest in other creatives so we could have a chance. It's just incredible. You know, companies talk a lot and organizations talk a lot about corporate social responsibility. And I think that is just the biggest bit of crappy sentence of all time, because they'll have this scorecard and they'll tick it off. And it's like, there's no genuine kind of commitment. There's no dollars necessarily going into that. It's to make their brochures look really nice and, you know, they've done the right thing. But it's about doing things for no reward for yourself. The reward goes to somebody else. So whether that is opening up opportunities for people to go through doors that they never would have got to go through and meet people they never would have dreamt of meeting, or whether it's about us as people, whether it's here, you know, a magnetic island in Yanbanan, like beautiful Yanbanan country, or whether it's in Victoria where I live on Wadawurrung land, you know, paying the rent. So going to organisations like Pay the Rent and paying a proportion of your income to pay your rent as part of your reparations for no reward. You know, it's not about advertising that you do it. It's just about, it's the right thing to do. And then other people determine where that money goes. You know, I think so often people want to give money, but they want something back. And I think that's what creators struggle with, especially with platforms like Patreon.
Yeah.
Is often it comes with expectations that I'll get 3 stickers in the mail every month. And gosh, I love getting stickers in the mail every month from different artists, but it's kind of subverting the idea of what a patron is. A patron would give you money and not expect anything in return. And so I like that idea of it's about giving, it's not about receiving. And how do you create those opportunities with no expectations? Or if you're writing, you know, for example, an organization, a company is writing a reconciliation action plan. Well, starting off, how are you employing Indigenous people? How are you connecting with that? If you're writing a child safety policy, how are you using consultants who have lived experience as victim survivors? You know, how are you kind of paying your reparations for what you're trying to fix in your organization? You might be having this whole green biodiversity strategy, but who are you actually contracting to do the work? Like, are you using people that have experience with climate change? It's how are you engaging in a genuine way? I'm all about genuine engagement. I think that's what it's about, you know. And when I've been engaged for my story, you know, I'm very blunt, and I think probably a little bit too blunt about my experience, because I've had the fortunate chance to do EMDR, so I've reprocessed my story. So to me, telling my story is, I don't have emotion necessarily attached to it. It's the same as if I told you what I ate for breakfast. But then when I see people's faces when I tell them the story, you know, of like 15 years of prolonged child sexual abuse and other people are involved and this, that and the other, and their face is just like, oh my gosh. And you kind of forget that your story is sad, or that your experience, Nat, you know, not to put words in your mouth, but your experience of fleeing Indonesia, that was really intense. And you forget the intensity sometimes, and then you tell it and then you see people's face, you're like, oh, but I'm like, stuff it, I'll still over it. I'm not oversharing, because you can't overshare your own story.
No.
You can't minimise your experience.
No, you can't.
Other people feel comfortable. And I think we spend, as creatives, we spend a lot of time trying to make other people feel comfortable or fit the brief for someone else, because we're also always on the hustle.
Yeah.
How can we get money? And you need money, but it's like, at what point do you say, no, I'm not compromising. I'm not going to take this job, or I am going to take this job because I'm going to use this money for something meaningful. It's sitting with that discomfort. It's figuring out what's your limit. And that is always changing. And I think it's so important to always be reflecting and coming back, circling back, reflecting on your experience, acknowledging your privilege, like looking at what's happening around you. If you're confident in what decisions you make as a creative person, whether that's in terms of what you're making or what meetings you go to or what galleries you show in, if you feel like you've done this kind of whole 360 look at the decision you're making and that sits well with you, then that's the right thing to do. I've spent the last 7 years working in retail, one, to build my confidence to kind of go from that sort of psychiatric setting back into the world, but also as an artist, you need to be always wearing these multiple hats. And sometimes, you know, I spent years waitressing at weddings and working in retail, and I got a lot out of those experiences and it gave me my confidence back. And it's only now at 41, after a long time of being in retail and hospitality, that I can now not have to do that work anymore. And so that's kind of, you know, there's no shame in having to take jobs that are not directly related, because if it's funding your passion and it's funding your ultimate end game, then you do whatever it takes. And if that means pouring 100 glasses of champagne for fancy people at their wedding, then that's what you do, because at the end of the day, that bought the fabric or the paints or the iPad Pro or whatever that might be, or it paid the rent, paid your school fees to be able to then go to the next step. So this, you know, I think being an artist, you learn quite quickly to be really humble, and you take what you can, and you rely on that gig economy so much. And I think that's one of the things that I'm really passionate about, is the National Association of Visual Artists, which is who I'm a member of, and because they have a really great membership. If you need public liability insurance and insurance things and you're an artist, I really, really recommend going. Their package is fantastic in terms of accessing insurance and support. And they also have these incredible templates of how to work out how much to charge someone, because I think that's what we're all really terrible at, is how much to charge someone for an hour of your time. you never know how to figure out how much to charge.
Yeah, that is definitely one of the biggest problems for a lot of creators and artists. I think you raise an interesting point too. Oh, do you mind just repeating that last, what you just said? Sorry.
Yeah, it was just around
internet.
Yeah. I think it's really important to join whatever association exists to support you as a creative. So I'm a member of the National Association of Visual Artists, and use their resources not only to cover my insurance, because that's a big cost. You know, if I have a show, I'd have $20 million of public liability insurance in case a work of art falls on someone. You know, and it's great to know that that's covered, but they're also fighting for a living wage for artists, because we should be receiving a living wage. And how much do we charge, and what does that look like? We're really good at making things, and we're really crap at knowing how much to charge and knowing how much something costs. It's always undervaluing. But also knowing that part of the process of being a creative is that you're never going to get your time back, and you're never going to really be able to truly charge time for is time. Money. Because if I charged for time to make, say I'm commissioned to do a quilt wall hanging that's the size of a king-size bed, for example, that's going to take me thousands of hours. Now, I'm never going to get $50 an hour for that, even though that's my hourly rate if I'm facilitating a community group. I'm never going to be able to charge 50 hours plus materials, plus creative vision, plus all of that. You know, eventually, I hope I might be able to charge $50,000 for a big commission. But at this point in my career, I need to accept that my time is, part of my time is an investment, but I also need to be unafraid to ask for money when I can.
Can I ask, for current and future artists, I think this is going to be really valuable hearing this from you. Obviously, you know, generating income, so you've had to work in retail. We're doing what we have to do until we can do what we want to do, but it's also looking at these opportunities. And in your case, I believe that you've mentioned accessing grants and these resources and services.
Yeah.
What does that process look like? If you're in a position where you are an artist and you're looking for these streams of income and you're really wanting to grow, what's the first step?
I'm a professional artist, yet I've never sold a work. I've never put a red dot on anything I've ever made, because for me, the ultimate goal of my work is change making. Mm. I might have a whole show and it might cost me thousands of dollars to put on a show, and I may not sell anything at that show. I might have changed people's thinking. And so to offset the cost of always applying for grants, so I'm always looking on the respective kind of creative department in whatever state, territory, country you might live in, like having a look at what grants exist, always applying for opportunities. Last year, for example, the City of Ballarat not only gave me a grant and have given me my own show in a community-owned gallery, but they also paid for a photographer to professionally photograph my work. Because that is something I could never afford, but I also need high-quality images to submit to be accepted into exhibitions, or if I want to turn them into prints, you know, if different opportunities present, to have them on my website, all of those things, you know. So I apply for so many things. Being a high achiever, I was always used to applying for a job and getting an interview, or applying for something and getting it. I always only ever applied for the things that I knew I'd get to avoid being disappointed. Mm-hmm. Whereas now I apply for maybe 10, 20 jobs, opportunities, grants, whatever that might look like. And I might get one out of 20. And that one that I get might be $300. But that $300 pays for a table that means that I can stand up when I cut my fabric and not have to go to the physio as often because I've got an ergonomic setting. Or it pays for a light so that I can see while I'm working and I'm not straining my eyes. Or it pays for the bills. You know, it's really about what can you do to look for other streams of income. And I can't recommend enough applying for grants or doing funded projects or mentoring programs or business startup programs. Going to those courses and accessing those opportunities is really, that's money, because you would pay to do that otherwise. So it's investing in yourself and your own professional development. I think also being a creative and being an artist, it's, you're constantly, you know, you're either on top of the world or you're feeling really disappointed that you didn't get something, and you're kind of just sitting with that all the time. And that's okay, because ultimately you're doing something that you enjoy. And if you don't enjoy it, then it's time to stop. if the overwhelming sense of always hearing no is too much, then maybe this isn't the right space for you to be in right now. So that's the thing. I think it's looking for opportunities, applying for everything, putting yourself out there, which is something I never would have done before. You know, like with my PhD, for example, I'm really lucky. My fees are covered by an Australian government research training program scholarship, which covers my fees. And then I was really fortunate in that I received an Australian government research training program stipend. So that means that I can work on my PhD full time, fully funded. So I get a wage essentially.
Wow.
I get $33,000 tax free to be able to work on my PhD. Now, $33,000 we know is not huge money by any stretch of the imagination, but for me, it's everything. It's more money than I, in the way it makes me feel, it's more money than I got when I got paid $150,000 a year. The government is recognizing that my, and the university is recognizing that my research is important. I also figured out what I needed to do to be able to achieve it. What was the criteria? How could I absolutely bust a gut to get there and worked my ass off last year to be able to do it? It was also other people applied who were equally as deserving as me. It just happened to be my time. And so now I'm really fortunate I get that chance to be able to spend the next 3 years working on my research while at the same time still looking for opportunities to exhibit as an artist, to hopefully gain gallery representation, to hopefully sell some works, to stick my first red dot. But to me, you know, my work is not necessarily made to be commercially successful. I don't necessarily make homewares. My work's not going to really match a couch. My work's going to sit hopefully in Parliament House or somewhere like that where decision makers are. They're going to think, what do we need to be doing to make the world better for children? What do we need to be doing to help incest survivors live successful lives as adults? What can we do to stop television producers making jokes about this? And how can we actually realise this is a serious problem that's happening in homes across the country and across the world? And so that's the point of my work. And I've been very fortunate to be able to have that principled approach to it. But that has meant that at the same time, I've had to do a whole lot of other jobs to fund that. Whereas I could be making really nice wall hangings, you know, or custom quilts and things and doing really well, but that's not necessarily where my heart lies, which my heart, my ultimate goal is social change. Anything else is a bonus.
Thank you so much for sharing that, particularly around how we can access grants and, you know, leaning into the programs that are essentially available in our local communities. Just listening to this, I feel like this is like a whole nother series on like how to write and secure grants with Lauren. I feel like there's a niche there for sure because, yeah, I've spoken to a few artists.
Is really hard.
I've spoken to a few artists. It's an art, isn't it? And it's quite, from what I understand, it is quite extensive and very process heavy and
it's a lot of work. It's really probably complex. 1 to 2 days per week working on pitches for grants or even like pitching to speak at a conference. Well, you don't get paid, don't get anything. You just to speak at the conference. I might spend days writing an abstract, working out what I'm going to say in a paper, you know, and I'll get rejected from that conference. I might not meet the criteria or the selection panel might think my topic is too risky, which is often a thing that I'd have to deal with as well. But just like being open to applying for everything and always asking the people that are going to read your application, ask them as many questions as you can. What are they looking for? What do they want to fund? And being really specific to that. I'm still not great at brevity. I know I need to get better at that. But maybe you have a friend who's a great writer, who might be a copywriter or just really good at writing. Asking them to read through stuff for you and then trading with them, you know, oh, well, I can help you with this. And whenever I find a grant too, I share it with people like, oh, this opportunity's out there, go get it. Like, you know, because if one person wins, we all win. You know, I think the grants and things to create like a really competitive environment and I don't think we can afford to be competitive. We need to be empowering people. And that's something that I've learnt. You know, in the beginning, I didn't tell people or I discouraged others from applying because I didn't want that to affect my chance because you're kind of in that self-preservation mode. But it's like that's when you're not successful. You can't kind of be a gatekeeper to information.
No.
Because, you know, I might see a grant online and be like, oh, that's a great grant. I'm going to apply for that. but then I don't tell anyone about it because, you know, I'm like, oh, I want to keep it a secret so I get it. When really it's like, I should share that with my friends and tell them that opportunity exists and we all can apply. And maybe they'll see, oh, actually, there's a lot of need. We might need to invest more money. Or, you know, the person that gets the grant might use me as a consultant on part of their project. So you never know.
I wonder if there's a service or app that spits out all these grants, if there's like an all-in-one.
Yeah, there is. So a few, it depends on what state you live in, but a few states and local governments have like grant finding. So Arts Hub is a website that I recommend everyone subscribes to and looks at. Arts Hub has, you pay a small fee, I think, to see the opportunities. It advertises jobs in the creative industries. Arts Hub also advertises grant opportunities, residency opportunities, different, you know, kind of funding programs. So always checking Arts Hub every week is, and subscribing to their newsletter is really important. Subscribing to your whatever state or territory you live in to their grant finding, their creative industries grants programs, and getting there on their email lists. Getting on the email list for the Australia Council, because they do a lot of grant investment and residency opportunities as well. Because often people think residencies are kind of out of reach. But for example, the Australia Council has a residency in Paris because they own two apartments in this artistic complex. And if you are successful in getting that residency, you also get a living allowance. So it's not costing you anything to be there. You're gaining the experience of going. Oh. Plus it's covering your costs. So yeah, definitely Arts Hub is the place to start. And yeah, you can break it down by state, territory, local area, opportunities, like job type. So anyone in creative industries, like I often see web developing jobs, social media content, like, and it's creative organizations that are posting those jobs there as well. So it's like-minded people looking for others.
Okay. I'm definitely going to be looking at that. That sounds really
interesting. Arts Hub is such a great place to look.
Helpful. So what's next on your journey? You're obviously a magnetic island right now doing a residency program at Jungle Club. But what's next for you?
What's next? Well, I had headshots taken today with George. So George Creative's based here out of Jungle Club as well. She's incredible talent. Like, and, you know, she's 22 and she's just going to be next level.
Agreed. She's phenomenal. She's the best.
Her vision. Amazing. And so we're starting that creative process. I never thought I needed a personal brand. I kind of thought it was a bit wanky, in all honesty. I was like, oh, no, I don't need that. And then I was like, oh, I'm just Lauren. That's fine. I'm like academic. I'm, you know, community arts, whatever. People find me. And then I actually realized over the course of the last few months, and especially, you know, in the lead up to coming here and stuff, maybe I do need a presence. Like I do need to identify who I am. And that is multifaceted. That's Daggy Lauren, that's academic Lauren, that's artist Lauren, that's community arts worker Lauren. It's so many different Laurens. I love the current version of me. I'm so excited. So I'm part of that strategy, George and I working together to kind of figure out how I can describe the different facets of who I am in my practice. So if I'm applying to speak at a conference, I've got the right headshot to send them. Because currently, you know, a selfie of me doing a thumbs up is not necessarily great to be on a conference website. People aren't necessarily going to take me that seriously. So, you know, it's having that I've come to realize that collateral is quite important. And it's also important because it means that people have places to go where they can find out what you do. Like, I'm such a hyphenate in terms of what I do, like, I do so many different things all the time, and having like really clear descriptions of all of those components, I think is going to be really important. And also it's fun. It's fun to figure out who you are and do that.
It is. It's always changing, but it's going to get you closer to, you know, for example, your values and what types of brands and work is going to align with that. It's all part of the process as a creator, is harnessing your personal power and your personal brand and how that this ties essentially ties into your profession and the work that you do. So that's really exciting.
Yeah, so that's so exciting. And then I have a solo show coming up that's opening on the 11th of February until the 5th of March at ArtSpace in Ballarat. And that is a show that is completely separate from my kind of research work, because my research work and the artwork that I create as part of my PhD is quite heavy. you know, it's exploring that incest experience and survival and the need for change generation. But one of my favorite things is scrolling through Facebook Marketplace, because it is so weird, so random, and the stuff that people sell is just so like, how? Why is someone going to buy it? Are they joking? Are they serious? They don't know. I don't know. It's just this kind of wild west out there. And so this show I have coming up called One Person's Trash is where I have printed out a whole lot of Facebook Marketplace ads that friends have sent me from all over the world, and I've embellished them with embroidery. So I've subverted what they're selling even more. Sometimes it's already pretty subverse. And so I've subverted that even more. And then so people can come along and see those different works and see kind of, it's called One Person's Trash because it's that saying, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Is it someone else's treasure or is it just junk? And how does that all relate to sustainability and things? So it's a bit of a fun show. It's a laugh, that's for sure. But it is serious. It
that sounds so fun.
I'm the biggest consumer of everyone. Like, I've been here for the last few weeks. My husband's like, literally, Lauren, every day more parcels come of things you've bought. I'm like, I'm just inspired. So I need to buy this book because I heard about it from someone talking. And he's like, oh, my gosh. But, you know, I think it's really interesting. And it gives us a chance to reflect on our own consumerism. And then you look on Facebook Marketplace and you can reflect on kind of the state of the world or the community you live in and what people are selling where you live. And I just think it's really funny and interesting. So people can come along to that if they're located in Victoria. What's the most interesting thing I've seen on Facebook Marketplace?
Yes. I'm very intrigued now.
Yeah, the weirdest thing. And
do you just set it to Ballarat or are you looking like the whole of Victoria?
No, so people send it to me from all over. So I put a call out about a year ago just to my Facebook friends.
My God.
So
I've had cool.
I've got friends in Nashville. I've got friends that have crawled marketplaces that are so obsessed with this project. I think the thing that got me started, the first piece that I saw that is the first artwork that I did was someone who was selling for $50 a trampoline with a giant hole in it and no springs. And they were like, this trampoline's all good. It just needs a new mat and spring. So essentially it needs to be a whole new trampoline. And so what I did was I sewed the hole together and I stitched on the springs and did all of that. You see some pretty wild spelling mistakes, which I really love as well. A set of stocks, like medieval stocks.
A set of stocks?
Of the sex toy, sex dungeon vein, but also folds up to be a seat in the garden if you wanted it to. But the way they described it was they called it medieval stokes. So that's kind of interesting, these medieval stokes. So that's pretty funny. I'm pretty into those. You know, lots of rings that are made up of carrots, as in the vegetable, not as in the carrots of diamonds.
Oh my God.
Yeah, it's wild. What? People selling a Cheeto that's shaped like a cowboy boot. People that sell two-minute noodles because their mate dared them that they can sell it on Marketplace. You know, it's a wild world out there on Marketplace. Like, if you're ever looking for entertainment, just, like,
that is...
sit and scroll.
I've got a friend who's starting a podcast where we're going to talk about random things from the interwebs, and this sounds like a topic that you need to be a part of. Facebook Marketplace. I'm going to connect you with her. Well, Lauren, thank you so much for your time today and sharing your story and your voice. We like to end the show by asking every creator the same eight quick fire questions. Just to wind down and have a little bit of fun, what is your personal superpower?
Connecting people with other people to create change.
Love that. Thank you.
I'm also very good at sewing.
That's so, yeah. Yes, you are. Who is your greatest inspiration in life for your creations? It can be a person or creator.
I would say the Guerrilla Girls as a sort of movement of feminist artists. Rosika Parker, who wrote The Subversive Stitch. The Riot Girl movement of the 90s. And Tracy Emin.
Great. Okay, what was your first paycheck and the job you were doing versus your latest paycheck and the job you're doing now?
My first paycheck was I worked, when I was about 15 as an after-school care assistant. And my latest paycheck I got was – my latest paycheck was I got my final paycheck from working in retail, and I also had someone pay an invoice for a community project I'd worked on.
Amazing. Next question. What was the most valuable investment you've made under $1,000 that benefits your personal and professional life? It can be time, energy, or money.
Under $1,000.
Yeah.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm.
It is, isn't it? About what I have, what I love, what makes my life easier. A good drink bottle.
Yes.
Like having a good drink bottle, staying hydrated. I think that emotional support water bottle is really important. And also, I think for me, investing in, for example, this residency or going on retreats or taking myself to a different location, I think that's the best investment you can make for yourself, is spending time with others or by yourself, focusing on creating or relaxing or doing those things. That's probably my kind of thing that I love. Plus also the cereal cup that I did buy. The milk and the cereal come out differently in your mouth, so you can have crunchy cereal while you're driving the car.
Oh, that my God. Wow. Yeah, okay, that's a good one. I love
the
these.
Cereal cup as well. Yeah, from the sublime to the ridiculous. Nah.
Perfect. Best book you've ever read that truly made you think differently?
How by Allen Ginsberg.
Hey, on the list now.
It's a book of poetry written in the 50s. The first line of it is, I saw the best minds of my generation destroyed by madness, starving, hysterical, naked. And, like, that's the greatest first line ever.
That is. Right with impact. Okay, what about one song that always gets you hyped?
Oh, Darude, Sandstorm.
Oh, my God, yes. That is, yes, it
like, I could tell you like one of the many songs Darude that I have tattooed on my body, but Darude Sandstorm, yeah, that's just, that is tits, that song.
That is the one, people, Darude Sandstorm. Okay, and last two questions. What is the worst piece of advice someone's ever given you?
That the mark you get at the end of year 12 is really important. It's not. I should have had more fun in high school. And,
oh, yeah, I don't know. High school, the last 2 years, I was a massive nerd. And then the whole way?
Always. Massive nerd. I feel like I could have had more fun. But I think, like, we put so much pressure on this single number and then no one asks you the number 10 years later.
No. Who even looks at it?
I didn't even do art in high school and now I'm an artist. Like, it's wild.
Final question. What is the best piece of advice you would give to a young creator or founder who's just starting out on their journey?
Well, this is a piece of advice that I got given last year from my beautiful, one of my mentors, Mark Robinson, who sadly passed away at the end of 2022. But he was one of the founders of Flack Studio and he invested in me along with others. And he said to me, never forget who you are and just work fucking hard. And I think that's the best piece of advice I've been given.
Fucking hard.
Just work fucking hard. Mm. Just keep doing it. But at the same time, don't forget who you are. Don't compromise on your values to fit into something else. Mm. Don't change yourself. Like, be true to you and what is at your core always. That's really important.
Thank you so much, Lauren, for your time and for sharing your personal journey and your career as an artist and, you know, words of wisdom around finding grants and finding these opportunities.
People can reach out to me on Instagram. So it's at Lauren Matthews Artist. And you can also visit my website, www.laurenmatthewsartist.com. Feel free to ask me a question. Done a lot of stuff, so I have a lot of random information stored in my head. So feel free just to ask. Never be afraid to ask anyone a question because all they can do is not answer you. If they do answer you, the answer you could get could change everything. So just ask. So if people want to ask me a question about being a victim survivor, about where to go for a good grant, what was the name of that website I spoke about, Arts Hub, just drop me a line. I'm there to have a chat. I love a good chat, as you've all heard.
And we love chatting with you as well. We'll also drop all of your social handles, your website, and your work at the bottom of our podcast episode. So thank you so much, Lauren.
Thank you for having me, my love. I
can't wait to see you next door.
Yeah, I'll see you in 10 minutes.
Friends of the internet, thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this app and you want to support us, please share it with other creators or leave us a rating and review. To stay up to date, you can follow me on Instagram at nat.asia and our community at The Personhood. See you next time.